have. You had to have an explicit violation of the Baran number symmetry that the standard model has classically. As there was some discussion at the very end of class, it's really, there doesn't have to be a totally violated global symmetry. So there can be some global symmetry that's exactly preserved, but you at least need to break the symmetry for a standard model baryon. So you can, for instance, have some hidden baryons and you kind of put the anti-baryon number there and you don't see it. But for standard model fields, you need to actually, if you just define it in terms of the transformation on visible quarks, you have to violate that symmetry. Then we also saw that you have to have CP violation in order to distinguish the matter from antimatter to accumulate an asymmetry. And this required both some interference between multiple processes and some CP odd and CP even phases. Yes.
So in MSSM, I think it's a B minus L that's preserved rather than B. Is that useful?
Even in a standard model, yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. You mean in terms of anomaly free? Only classically. So we'll talk about that today. Yeah. So generally, the MSSM breaks all of your accidental symmetries because you're adding in new scalars that have, you know, charges that are like quarks, and so you break your Baran number and Lepton number. So usually people impose an R parity, which restores the Baran and Lepton number. So then basically all the MSSM inherits all of the symmetry structure of the standard model. Okay, and so then the last point was a departure from thermal equilibrium, and so that's what we'll talk about right now. And then what we'll do is we'll see how these conditions are or aren't violated in the standard model. So that will tell us whether we can actually get a Baran asymmetry just from standard model processes. And so for this, there's sort of a quick proof of this, which doesn't necessarily have a lot of physical intuition contained in it, but sort of quickly allows us to see that you can't have a Baran number asymmetry in thermal equilibrium. So what we can do is we can write an expectation value of the charge of Baran number. This is proportional to some trace over all of the states weighted by the Boltzmann factor times the operator, which counts the number of baryons in each of your quantum states. And then what we'll do is we'll add in insertions of the identity operator. Okay. And so what I'll do is I will take the identity operator, and this is equal to, if I have some parity, any like discrete symmetry that is a Z2 symmetry, I can square it, and that gives me the identity. So in particular, there's a symmetry that's called CPT, which is a combination of charge, parity, and time conjugation. And it's basically the CP symmetry we've been talking about already, but then you also reverse the arrow of time. And what's nice about CPT symmetry is that there's a theorem called the CPT theorem, which says that any Lorentz invariant relativistic theory conserves CPT, which means that your action necessarily is even under this transformation. Okay. So what this implies for the case if I have CP violation is that there's also some time reversal invariance violation, that the two of those things, when I put them together, gives me conserved CPT. So this means that I can put in my operator here. Okay, and now I use the fact that what are the transformation properties of any charge under CPT? Yes, Tibra.
So CPT, that's just the product of the three operations.
That's right.
So when you take the inverse, that reverses the order.
That's right.
But in principle, if you didn't have to decompose identity like that, the CPT itself is identity, right? Is that something that you think about?
Well, sorry, what do you mean? That's right. So this is just the fact that it's a Z2 symmetry, and so when I square it, I get the identity. So, yeah. Well, okay. So this is just a trivial statement. Okay. Then you can make the argument that if this. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So what I can do is I can use the fact that Baran number itself doesn't have any transformation properties under parity or time reversal. Okay? So whether I'm going forward or backward in time, if I have some number of baryons lying around, it's still the same number of baryons. So this is odd under C, and even under P and T. So it's odd under C because if I flip all of my charges, then baryon number goes to anti-baryon number. Okay? So what this means is that this gives me minus B. We got minus trace minus beta H CPT B. So it is also odd under CP because it's even under P. That's right. But so this is distinguishing between a baryon number, which is just some charge, and like the number of particles versus antiparticles, which is something that's CP. So if I actually want to count the baryon charge among some set of particles, it's going to be the CP that is important. But this doesn't depend at all on like what the Lorentz structure of my field is or anything. I'm just treating this as I'm integrating this global charge. Okay, so now what I can do is I can use the fact that the trace is cyclic, the fact that I can sort of, as long as I move everything in the same, keep it in the same order, I can move stuff from the end of the trace to the beginning of the trace. So I got CPT inverse e to the minus beta H CPT B. And because my theory is invariant under CPT transformations, this is basically telling me that my Hamiltonian is even under CPT. Okay. So this gives me e to the minus beta h . So what I see is that trace of e to the minus beta hb is equal to minus trace e to the minus beta hb . So the only way that this is possible is if this is equal to zero. So this tells me that in equilibrium, my expectation value of baryon number is zero. Okay. And we can understand this thermodynamically, what's happening, just if we think about an analogous situation where if I have, say, two rooms and I put a permeable membrane between them and I put gas A here, gas B, then what's going to happen is all of the A's are going to move in here and the B's are going to move in here. I'm going to end up with a totally mixed state in equilibrium. So this is a familiar result. And if you like, the transfer and asymmetry is kind of the same thing. I sort of have these two buckets. There's baryons and antibaryons, and there are interactions that allow me to turn baryons into antibaryons. And just in equilibrium nature, entropy doesn't like it when I have some separation of things into two different regions. Okay, so I essentially have some B and B bar, and if I can freely exchange them, then they're going to equalize. And so basically, if I happen to end up with some short-lived baryon excess, that's going to increase the rates driving B to BB bar and equalize it. Similarly, if I have some sort of momentary fluctuation where I have more B bars, that's going to drive an increase in the rate going in the opposite direction. So the moral of the story is that we just don't want to have full thermal equilibrium. So there's a bit of a conflict here. And this is sort of a general conflict for baryogenesis, which is that I want some interactions that convert, say, zero baryon number to one baryon number. I want these to be pretty fast, because if this is a small effect, I just don't generate a lot of baryon number. So I want this to be large. But then I want the processes that go like one baryon number to minus one baryon number to be small, because these are the things that tend to destroy baryons and convert baryons into antibaryons. And so these two things seem incompatible. Okay, so what we need is some small difference in the rates, say. Of gamma B, say production versus, so I should say, we typically refer to this as the production of the Baryon asymmetry, and this is the washout of the Baryon asymmetry. So these are related diagrams, but there are some small differences between them. Okay, so gamma production versus gamma B washout. So these rates can be slightly different, and so maybe you can have one of them go out of equilibrium first. So, gamma over H measures whether it's in equilibrium. So the whole goal of baryogenesis is to try to arrange things so that, you have the expansion of the universe, which can push things in and out of equilibrium. You kind of want to have it so that, this thing shuts off and you still create some amount of Baryon number, and then that's just left over. Okay. But if things have a lot of time such that they can equilibrate, then all of your Baryon asymmetry just goes away. Okay, and we'll see explicitly when we get to an example of baryogenesis, probably tomorrow, more concretely what I mean. But generally speaking, you need to have some point at which equilibrium is violated. Okay, are there any questions about this, Ryan? Well, so I mean, I can always just add a blob here. And so, because if I have a process that creates one Baryon number, I can have one that destroys Baryon number. So I can sort of put another blob, and that gives me a B to anti-B diagram. And because CP violation typically comes at higher order in perturbation theory, you often get that the production and the washout are at the same order in perturbation theory. So they're directly competing with one another. Okay. So for today, the rest of today, we're going to talk about baryogenesis in the standard model. And the basic question we want to ask is, are the Sakharov conditions satisfied in the standard model? Because if they are, and it turns out that they are to some degree, if we could get a large enough Baryon asymmetry just from standard model processes, then we would just say, okay, this is an understood feature of the standard model, and it's at, in fact, some selling point of the standard model that it can also explain the Baryon asymmetry. But as we'll see, the answer is sort of yes, but not enough. So you generate some small asymmetry, but it's not large enough to account for the asymmetry that we observe. Okay. So we'll go through each condition. So we have them there. So we'll start with Baryon number violation. Okay. So if I write down my Lagrangian, the things that are charged under Baryon number are the quarks. And so my action looks sort of like Q bar L, gamma mu d mu Q L plus the right-handed quarks. So this will consist of the up and the down, and then a Yukawa coupling that connects the left-handed and the right-handed quarks. And so I see just explicitly that if I take any q and take it to e to the I alpha q, this is conserved. Okay, so we have we have classical V conservation. But just as we were talking about with the pseudo Goldstone for the vacuum misalignment production of dark matter, in quantum mechanics, it's a little trickier because if I write out my path integral looks something like Euclidean space d psi bar, e to the minus s classical and psi bar. So if I want my full quantum theory to be invariant, I need my classical action to be invariant. That's sort of a necessary thing. But I also need this rotation of when I take psi to e to the I alpha psi, the path integral measure also has to be invariant. And it turns out that it's not invariant, so you end up with an anomaly if the symmetry is chiral. Okay, and chiral means that it acts differently in some sense on left-handed and right-handed fields. Okay, and so they come from computing these diagrams where I put some insertion of the global symmetry current, so the U1 Baryon number, and it's in some background of gauge fields. So in the standard model, this can be the hypercharge, it can be the SU2 left, the SU3C, and same for these ones. Yes? So it turns out in the standard model, it's chiral. So you're performing the same symmetry transformation on left and right-handed quarks, but they have different gauge charges. So in effect, you generate an anomaly because what really matters is the sort of total number of left and right-handed quarks of each type. Okay. So if you like, I can write the standard model purely in terms of left-handed quarks. So I can turn this Q right into Q left C. Okay. So then it's sort of explicitly a chiral symmetry. I'm only rotating left-handed quarks. And then what I need to do is figure out what are their effects in this loop. Okay. And if it's a vector-like theory, what it means is that all of the various quark contributions will cancel each other. So there's some way in which there's a left and right a symmetry under which the two things transform the same. But here in the standard model, this Q left is an SU2 doublet, and the Q right is an SU2 singlet. And so if I look at the contribution, say, for this loop with SU2 gauge bosons, then what I'll find is that the Q left contributes in this loop, and the Q right does not contribute in this loop. So I end up with a non-cancellation. Okay, and you'll see this explicitly in the tutorial today. You'll have lots of fun like putting in factors of a third for Baryon number and the hypercharge, and you'll see exactly what the anomaly in this thing is. Okay. So what we find is that U1B is anomalous under, so in, I should say, in a background where we have an SU2 left gauge theory and a U1Y gauge theory. So the anomaly cancels for SU3, and the simple answer to that is that my left and right-handed quarks, I have the same number of those under SU3. So I have an up left, a down left, an up right, and a down right. And when I compute these loops, they all contribute the same to the SU3 diagram. Okay, so this leads to a non-conservation of the current. So you get something that looks like this. And then there's also a hypercharge term. It turns out that this won't actually be particularly relevant, so I don't want to write it out. And this current is basically the sum over all of the quarks, a third Q bar gamma mu Q. So this is both left and right-handed quarks transform this way. But in order to evaluate this diagram, we have to decompose them into left and right-handed quarks in order to get the correct gauge charges. Okay. Okay, so the current just has a non-zero divergence, and so what does that tell me? That tells me that that basically this term gets added onto my action when I perform a transformation of Baryon number. Okay. And what I can do is I can compute the effects of this. So I can say, well, what is the physical change in the Baryon number? So to get that, I use the fact that this difference in charges is basically an integral over time. Times the divergence of the current. Because this tells me how much it changes when I do some transformation on it. And so this has the form of d4x 3 g weeks squared over pi squared trace. Sorry, this is 16. Trace w tilde. So I should remind us that w tilde is a half epsilon mu nu rho sigma w rho sigma. Okay, and it turns out that this is a topological invariant. So we talked yesterday or the day before about how this thing actually is a total derivative. And so what you do is you turn it into a surface integral on the boundary. And if your gauge fields don't fall off fast enough, then this actually picks up some contribution from the gauge fields, even though the gauge fields are formally going to zero at infinity. So this doesn't contribute to your perturbation theory, but it gives you some term, which is called the Chern-Simons number. Okay. And the Chern-Simons number is related to a winding of the gauge fields. Okay, so it basically has to do with the fact that the actual vacuum solutions to gauge theory are, I want my F mu nu equal to zero for a vacuum. So if I want a finite energy configuration, this has to go to zero as I go far enough out. But this does not actually mean that A is equal to zero. Okay. Just because this consists of derivatives of A along with, so for instance, I can perform a gauge transformation and change what A is and keep F zero, okay, essentially. So the details of this aren't particularly important for our purposes. The only thing that matters is that you have these different vacuum configurations of the gauge field, and they have different numbers of baryons in them, which is sort of a weird thing, right? So I can draw a schematic picture. Okay. And so I have something like, so this is going to be basically my winding number. And this is also related to the Chern-Simons number. So you can define the winding number on a path as just I take a point, I count the number of times that that my field is wrapped around this. Okay. So I'll have a winding number 0. This maybe has no baryons. Have a winding number of 1. This will have a baryon number of 3. Winding number of 2 has a baryon number of 6, etc. Okay. And these are my vacua. Okay. So I see that if I can have transitions between the different gauge theory vacuums, then I change the number of baryons that I have lying around, just due to the fact that this theory is anomalous. Okay? And we know that in terms of some classical energy fluctuations of the field around that vacuum, each of these vacua is sort of like a little potential well. So the general picture that you have is that there are these multiple peaks and troughs. And each of these separates sort of a vacuum with a different number of baryons. And if I start here and I sort of hop into different vacua, then I can change my number of baryons. Yes, Tibor.
So the specific number you wrote down for P, is that like just a illustration or?
No, this is actually the number. So because changing the winding number by 1 changes your baryon number by 3, by that factor there. That's right. So there's in each vacuum, there's a definite number of baryons, but I don't know which vacuum I started in. So if I start in this one, let's say I have no net baryons. So this I should remind myself is B total equals NB minus NB bar. Okay. So let's say I start on this one. If I want to create baryons, I need to go hopping to higher vacua, okay, to be consistent, say, with what I've observed. So the point is that in the standard model, the vacuum structure of the gauge theory actually encodes init baryon number violation. Okay. So baryon number is not expected to be conserved. But a key question is what are the transitions between vacua? Because if I never move from one vacuum to the other, then I'm just never going to change baryon number. Okay. And so it turns out that there are two different ways of changing B. So one is basically by tunneling between vacua. So that's if I just go straight through. And this is a purely quantum mechanical effect. It's completely analogous to tunneling that you looked at sort of in your first course, and you do sort of a WKB approximation to calculate it. And the second is just a classical evolution over the barrier. So what this means is that if I just, you know, I'm at a finite temperature, if there's just enough energy concentrated in the gauge field, then there's some perturbation of the gauge field that can change its winding number. And so I can push myself up into the next vacuum. But I need to have enough energy to do that. Because unlike the tunneling, where I don't actually have to have enough energy, I just need to sort of wait long enough and I'll tunnel. This depends on what my energy density is. Okay? So this is sort of the dominant process at zero temperature. And this is the dominant process at finite temperature. And these are referred to as instantons. This is the name applied to the gauge field configuration. And these are referred to as sphalerons. OK. And as with all things related to this, it's non-perturbative. So we're not going to get into any details because it's very complicated. But what we can do is we can estimate the effect. So for instantons, there's actually a formula which I wrote down on the board a few days ago. There's something called a Bogomolnik. I have such a hard time pronouncing this. Bogomolnik bound, which essentially relates the action for the winding number. So this is the F tilde part of the action to the total action, which has a part that's both FF and FF tilde. So this is the normal kinetic term. This is the weird anomaly term. And there's a way that you can relate these two. Okay? And what you find is that this action is larger than 8 pi squared over g squared times the number of vacua that you're changing. Okay? And I'm not going to derive it, but you can see that it's plausible that you have one over coupling because this is a non-perturbative effect. Okay. So if I plug in g equals g weak, which is about, I don't know, 0.6 or so, I find an S of about 170. And so my path integral, which goes like e to the minus x, goes like e to the minus 170. And this is so small that it's practically negligible. So this explains why even though baryon number is violated in the standard model, at zero temperature we don't actually see any effects of baryon number violation, just because this can be seen as some sort of probability per unit volume is so vanishingly small it just never happens.
Yes. So the value of g, we are including that.
Mm-hmm.
What's delta n?
So that's the number, so this is for n equals 1. So this is the transition between one vacuum. So that's just to change a single baryon number in my, say, Hubble volume is some very, very tiny probability. Okay. So this has no effect. And this explains why baryon number symmetry seems to be such a good symmetry, because you know, for all intents and purposes, it is not broken. Okay. However, at finite temperature, you have just classical field fluctuations. So instantons are a quantum mechanical effect. But now I just have a gauge field that's moving around. And there's some possibility the gauge field's motion will cause it to sort of wrap around itself at extra time, say. Okay? And so these fluctuations have an energy that's comparable to the temperature. And so we want to see how do finite temperature effects change this story. And so it was discovered in the 80s that there is something called a sphaleron. And this is basically what happens if I consider a solution, so gauge field solutions, to the classical equations of motion. So I take my n winding number vacuum solution. And I take my n plus 1 winding number vacuum solution. And these both satisfy the F equals zero on the boundary. So their actions are the same. The energy of these vacua are the same. And what I do is I just write down some interpolation between them. Basically, I put in some parameter. I say, OK, this is the functional form of one vacuum. This is the functional form of the other vacuum. I require them to solve the classical equations of motion. And so I imagine that what that's doing is it's sort of taking me up and then back down the other side. So then what this Fallaron does, what the Fallaron solution does, is you find the parameter which maximizes the energy, the free energy. And this gives me an estimate of the barrier height. And that tells me roughly how much energy do I need to push myself from one vacuum to another. And this is a very difficult calculation to do, but I expect that my rate of B violation is going to go like e to the minus the energy of this Fallaron over the temperature. So this is just a Boltzmann factor. And I'm just saying, okay, well, I calculate what's the energy barrier to move from this vacuum to this vacuum, and then what's the Boltzmann factor tells me what's the probability of concentrating that much energy in one particular field configuration. Okay, so this is a difficult non-perturbative calculation, and there's a lot of controversy even now. So when this was first developed, people didn't even really believe that this Fallaron was mediating vacuum transition. So it took maybe 10 years for the dust to settle, and now it's pretty much accepted that this is a real physical effect. Okay? And lattice calculations and analytic calculations have kind of converged on some answers. Okay. And what those answers say is that the energy of this Fallaron depends on whether we're in the broken phase of the gauge theory or the symmetric phase of the gauge theory. So for the broken phase, it turns out that the energy is about the mass of the W over alpha W times some order one factor. So the broken phase is relevant for temperatures less than about the Higgs VeV, which is about 250 GeV. So if you like, this is just some output of a theory calculation. Okay. In the symmetric phase, there is no mass of the W because the symmetry hasn't been broken. And so the only thing it can depend on is the temperature. And it turns out to scale like alpha weak to the power of the fifth. So alpha weak is G weak squared over 4 pi. So this is the symmetric phase. Okay, so I know that gamma is proportional to, basically like a factor of the temperature times this Boltzmann factor. I now know what the energy is, and so I can just go and say, is gamma bigger than Hubble or smaller than Hubble? Okay. Which is our usual way of determining whether something is fast enough to be in equilibrium. And so by making a direct comparison, what I can do is figure out when exactly these barrier number violating interactions were fast. Okay, and that's when I need to have baryogenesis happening. Okay. So let's consider first T smaller than the Higgs VeV. So this is a broken phase. Okay, so I can just write down my gamma is proportional to e to the minus basically 2mw over alpha over the temperature. Yes. Yeah, of the Higgs field. So this is the SU2 isotop. So it turns out that a U1 doesn't have any topologically non-trivial winding number. So the hypercharge doesn't contribute to any of this. It's just the SU2 left. Okay. So MW over alpha is pretty big. Okay. MW over alpha is about 10 TeV. So I'm going to say, okay, well, if my temperature is 200 GeV and my M over alpha is 10 TeV, then this rate is very exponentially suppressed. Okay. So what we find when you plug in the numerics is that the Fallarons are out of equilibrium in the broken phase. And as we go to zero temperature, this dies off and you end up with the instanton calculation. Okay, what about for t bigger than v? So now I don't have any exponential suppression, right? Because my my energy goes like alpha to the fifth over t, so this is some small number, it's an order one factor. So I find that this gamma is sort of order temperature-ish, which at the weak scale is much larger than the Hubble. So what we find is rapid Baron number violation in the symmetric phase. So for temperatures above the Higgs VEV. So we do actually find that Baron number is broken in the standard model and that there are actual physical effects of Baron number breaking. So in the early universe, I can quickly change the number of baryons. And this is totally consistent with the fact that we don't observe proton decay or anything else that you would think of as an application of Baron number violation, just because of the fact that nowadays we're in this broken phase and the rate is zero, essentially. Okay, but it could have been non-zero at an early time. And in fact, everything seems to suggest that it was non-zero. Okay. So we have B violation. Now, another thing we want to point out is that lepton number symmetry is also anomalous. So this is what happens if I take all of my lepton fields and I change them by a phase, you know, L goes to e to the I alpha L. And as you'll see in the tutorial today, these anomalies are actually the same. And so if I take a U1 symmetry that's B minus L, this is not anomalous. Okay, so even though I have these rapid Baron number changing interactions, because this symmetry is not anomalous, this means that, you know, B minus L is the same. So L is 0, L is 3, L is 6, et cetera. But if I construct this particular quantity, changing vacuum, it doesn't actually change my total B minus L number. Right? So what's important about this is that this implies that you know, if B minus L is conserved, which it generally is, at least in the standard model, then in addition to, you know, B going to BB bar kinds of, sorry, B going to B bar transformations, I also have Baron number going to lepton number. Okay? So I can either create a baryon asymmetry and then some of it will propagate into the leptons, or I can create a lepton asymmetry and some of it will propagate into the baryons. But I actually only need to create an asymmetry in either baryons or leptons. And then the sphalerons will kind of equalize everything. And then I'll end up with a non-zero, so it's generic. If B minus L is not zero, then B is not zero and L is not zero. So I generally end up with asymmetries in both sectors. Conversely, it means that even if I go through the hard work of generating a baryon asymmetry, but I keep B minus L equal to zero, then sphalerons will just totally wipe out any asymmetry, because it tends to drive B and L to be the same. Yes?
Yeah, do you elaborate more on why it would tend to make B and L the
same? So the reason is that, the fact that B minus L is conserved,
which is what you got on that,
yeah,
that diagram there. Why you're saying that we'll always end up in the middle.
If you keep B minus L is equal to zero.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess you start.
So the reason is that, again, nature doesn't really like to have an asymmetry. So if I find myself here, but my baryon and lepton number are the same, then I can just, by hopping, get back into a B equals zero, L equals zero vacuum. So what? That's right. So if this happens,
why do we expect that once it's, so I mean, how it usually goes, right, is it high temperatures, this is all happening, mm-hmm. and then it drops below the span of temperature and then it's basically frozen out.
Yes.
So why would we expect it to be frozen out exactly in the middle? Why would we not expect it to be frozen out somewhere?
Right, so that depends on the scale at which you're generating your asymmetry. But so let me put it this way. So what you can think of a sphaleron is basically a field configuration that takes 9 quarks, so 3 top quarks, 3 charm quarks, and 3 up quarks, and turns them into 3 leptons. Okay. So what this is telling me is that my baryon number and lepton number asymmetry are actually, like, the symmetry is the same thing. Okay, so if this process is going quickly, then I can quickly convert one into another. And so the same equilibrium arguments about not having a net B apply to this scenario as well, where if I have some B and some L, then I can quickly turn Bs into, how does this work? Yeah, sorry, this goes to an L bar. Okay. So, wait, baryon number and lepton number are the same. Yeah. So, pardon me? Yeah. That's right, it goes to an L bar. So if you like, if I have B equals to some number K and L equals to some number K, then sphalerons will just convert this into an anti-lepton number and annihilate with this lepton. And so I end up with no net asymmetry. So it's the same argument for why there isn't a B versus a B bar, just in equilibrium. But it, really what you have to do is you have to, this implies certain relationships between the chemical potentials or the asymmetries of these fields. And so you write down all of the relations between the chemical potentials, you end up with some system of like 9 linear equations and you solve them. And you can just see explicitly, if I set the B minus L number to 0, everything goes to 0. Okay, that's the only solution to the equations. So what I want is I want to find myself in a vacuum where I have B minus L is not equal to 0. That's sort of the one of the key points here. So if I just create B or I just create L, that's fine. But if I'm creating an asymmetry in both at the same time, then sphalerons will wipe it out. Okay, so CP violation of the standard model. So the condition number 1 is satisfied as long as my baryogenesis is happening above the weak scale. And it turns out that there are 2 CP violating parameters in the standard model. There's a so-called theta parameter, which we discussed briefly last time. And this, the Lagrangian looks like trace of G d tilde times this theta. And this theta violates CP. But there are 2 reasons why this is irrelevant. So measurements of the neutron EDM, we talked about this, constrain theta to be less than about 10 to the minus 10 or 10 to the minus 11. So this is already a very small CP violating parameter. And then you have this extra fact that, so this is the main reason why it's not relevant. Like the total baryon asymmetry we're trying to get is of order 10 to the minus 10. And if you calculate the effects of this, it's always this phase times some small number. So this is basically too small to do anything. So the other CB phase is, it's called the CKM phase. And it comes from the fact that in the standard model, we have a bunch of Yukawa couplings. And these Yukawa couplings are generally complex. So what I do is the Higgs gets a VEV, and hopefully you saw this in your standard model class, the Higgs gets a VEV. And what I want to do is write down diagonal mass terms. So I have to diagonalize these matrices. And it turns out that I can't quite diagonalize these at the same time. Okay? So I can diagonalize these at the same time by doing rotations on the Q left, U, and D field, but only at the expense of introducing some off-diagonal piece in the charge gauge interactions. So once I diagonalize the masses, I end up with my interaction that looks like this, U bar I times this matrix called the CKM matrix. Gamma mu, W mu, D, LJ. But secretly, this is encoding the fact that that I have all of these different like entries here as well as phases, and by doing redefinitions of the fields, I can't quite get rid of all of the off-diagonal components. Okay, so there's some analysis that you can do which says, you know, okay, well, what are the independent entries of the CKM matrix? This is a 3x3 unitary matrix. And so I can express the parameters. There are 9 parameters. So half of the parameters are removed by the unitarity condition. And so I get 3 mixing angles and 6 phases in my CKM matrix. So naively, it looks like I have a ton of CP violation because I have 6 complex parameters in my Lagrangian. But as we talked about last time, you can actually remove phases that naively appear in your Lagrangian by doing a field redefinition. So I have 6 phases, and I have 6 quarks that I can do some kind of Q goes to e to the I theta Q to remove some of the phases. And if you look at this, you can see that if I rephase all of my quark fields, so these are the, you know, up and down type 3 generations, basically. If I rephase all of my fields, I don't actually change anything. So the fact that I have 6 quarks means that I have 5 rephasings that I can do. So basically 5 field redefinitions. So what I'm left with is 1 CP phase, which is usually called delta CKM. And if you repeat this analysis with only 2 generations of quarks, you'll see that I can actually get rid of all of the phases. Okay, so this CP phase depends on there being 3 kinds of quarks. So what this tells me, and you can show this more rigorously, but I'm just arguing heuristically now, is that physical processes require all 3 generations for CP violation. Because if not all 3 of the generations show up in my process, I can sort of redefine my fields, and then the CP phase disappears from my amplitude. Okay? So what this tells me is that, as far as we can tell, delta CKM, this is some angle, it's about pi over 2 or pi over 4 or something. It's a large angle. But because of the fact that you have to go through all 3 generations of the standard model, and the standard model has this weird structure where the different generations are almost aligned with one another. So the mixing angles between them are kind of small. And the masses hierarchies are very different. So even though the parameter in your Lagrangian looks big, the physical CP violation is small. And there are actually very stringent constraints on CP violation from standard model measurements. We've been able to measure things quite well. So there's some parameter that we can use, which is essentially a, what's the word I'm looking for? It's sort of a basis independent measure of CP violation, because I can sort of take this phase, and by doing field redefinitions, I can push it into different components of my CKM matrix. So it's not sufficient to just write down the CKM matrix. I have to come up with some combination of CKM matrix elements that is invariant under all reparameterizations of my fields. And it turns out that this invariant has a form. I take the product. So here I'm talking about different quark generations. I basically take m up I squared minus m up j squared, m down I squared minus m down j squared, times some function of the mixing angles in my CKM matrix, times the sine of this delta CKM. Okay, and you can see that if any of the up or down type quarks masses happen to be degenerate, I have some enhanced symmetry in my theory, which allows me to even rotate away this delta CKM phase. So what you end up with is this function of lots of products of quark masses, okay, times this thing, which is generally small, because you're multiplying it by a bunch of mixing angles. There are also some cosines in here, but these are generally large. So the details aren't important. The point is that the sort of physical effect of CP violation is this parameter A. Now this parameter A has dimension 12 because I'm multiplying powers of four masses times essentially three contributions from the quark generations. So if I want some dimensionless quantity, I need to divide it by something, okay? And we see that the lowest possible energy at which baryogenesis can happen is this Higgs-Vev, because if it happens below the Higgs-Vev, I don't have any baryon number violation. So this is sort of some dimensionless estimates. And this is kind of hand-wavy, but it allows you to get an order of magnitude sense of how big CP violation is. And if you plug in all of the numbers, this comes out to be 10 to the minus 20. So the estimate is, if I actually want to use this delta CKM phase at the weak scale, because of the fact that some of the quark masses are so small, I'm very close to not having any CP violation physically in my theory. And so my effective quantity is extremely small. So this, you know, if I'm trying to get an asymmetry of order 10 to the minus 10, this is also too small. So CP violation doesn't work. So I'll end up with an asymmetry, but it will be many, many orders of magnitude too small just for my estimate of CP. And you can try to construct ways of getting around this argument, and people have constructed sort of weird things, that arguments for why maybe you could actually make this number bigger, but no one's actually been able to make a theory that effectively has, you know, like write down a interaction that has a large CP violation contribution, okay? Okay, so we already have a sense that baryogenesis is not going to work just because we have too little CP violation in the standard model. But it turns out we also have constraints from the departure from equilibrium, which namely comes from the fact that in order to have baryogenesis, we need to have some arrow of time. So this corresponds to, say, rates that go below Hubble or mass thresholds that cause rates to go below Hubble. So there have to be some feature in my theory. Okay. And it has to be at temperatures above the weak phase transition. Except at temperatures above the weak phase transition, none of the standard model particles have any mass. So I don't really have any mass thresholds or kind of clear places at which equilibrium is violated. And so you can think for some time if you want, but if you just include standard model particles, you don't actually have any departures from thermal equilibrium before the phase transition. Okay, so there's one clear flaw in this argument, which is that I just wrote down a scale here, which is the Higgs-Vev. Okay, so there's at least one scale at which equilibrium conditions change. And we saw that here. We saw that the sphalerons are out of equilibrium below V and in equilibrium above V. Okay, so it seems like there's something interesting happening at V, and that's sort of our best case for this to happen. And so to do this, we have to understand a little bit about the electroweak phase transition. So, you know, how does the universe go from the Higgs equals zero to Higgs not equals zero? And you can think of this as some analogy with, say, ferromagnetism, where if I'm at high temperatures, there's enough entropy in the system to prevent all of the spins from aligning. But if I cool the system down enough, then all of the spins will align a certain direction. So I can go from some, you know, average zero magnetization to a non-zero magnetization. So basically, the same thing happens for the Higgs. The Higgs potential actually, it receives finite temperature loop corrections. And so, you know, I can write down loops involving my Higgs field. So this is, say, a mass correction. There's this Coleman-Weinberg potential that I can write down for the Higgs. These are all things I can compute at zero temperature. But at finite temperature, there's some possibility that in addition to sort of virtual particles running in the loop, I can have actual physical particles from my bath running in the loop. My bath. Okay. And so what this gives me is temperature dependence on the mass. And so I end up with something that looks like this. So this is a temperature that's much larger than the VeV. The Higgs potential is actually stabilized at the origin. This is very different from, say, the Mexican hat potential that we had looked at. But at lower temperatures, the thermal corrections go away, and I end up with something that looks like this. And this symmetry is broken exactly at the point where my vacuum here and my vacuum here that's forming are degenerate with one another. Oops. Okay. So there are sort of two possibilities. So this is basically at T is approximately V. Okay, so it's possible that what happens is as I'm going from finite temperature down to zero temperature, this stays sort of in the same shape, and I end up with something that's basically flat and then goes up. Okay. The other possibility is that this vacuum sort of forms here. And so there's a barrier, and then as the temperature drops, I don't have this continuous deformation. I sort of have a bump. So the other possibility looks like this. Oh, it's the same color. What am I doing? And these have qualitatively different behavior. Because if there's a bump, I just stay sitting here until this VeV drops a lot, and then I sort of tunnel through the barrier into the vacuum. So this is sort of a tunneling solution. The other option is that I just sort of slowly roll out. Okay. And the point is that for the tunneling solution, which is what we typically refer to as a first order transition, I basically instantly go from Higgs equals zero to Higgs equals, you know, 246 GeV. Because there's this barrier here, this drops, and I just go out. Okay. If I look at my sphaleron rates, what I see is that I'm immediately jumping from the broken phase, from the symmetric phase in equilibrium to the broken phase out of equilibrium. So this is a very rapid transition. And this is a strong departure from equilibrium. So speaking to a point that Kieran made, what's basically going on here is that you have these sort of small fluctuations of net baryon number, net anti-baryon number. And the sphalerons usually equalize, you know, say, the relative baryon and lepton numbers. But if the sphalerons shut off very fast, then I can sort of be caught in this fluctuation that happens to be a baryon number. Okay? And so this is sufficient for satisfying my condition. Whereas if I do the rolling solution, which is called the second order transition, I gradually go from gamma sphaleron bigger than h to gamma sphaleron less than h. And so I don't get this effect of I can end up with some baryon asymmetry because of some sudden switch off of the thing that violates my baryon number. And so this is not sufficient for baryogenesis, whereas this is sufficient for baryogenesis. And since we're out of time, I won't go into much more detail about this, but the important thing is that This is the correct description for m Higgs less than about 70 GeV. And this is the correct description of the phase transition if you do the full non-perturbative numerical calculation for m Higgs bigger than 70 GeV. So since the Higgs mass that we observe is 125 GeV, we find ourselves firmly in this kind of phase transition. And because the phase transition happens very slowly, this Fallerons very slowly shut off, I don't end up with any appreciable Baron asymmetry. Yes, Karen. That's right. That's right. So, I can talk a little bit more about it tomorrow. We can talk about it later. But you have to care about what's happening right at the like phase transition boundary. So here's V equals zero, and here's V not equal to zero. And basically, this is like sweeping outwards, either in time or spatial sense. And so there's some baryon number violating processes that happen here that create sort of a small excess of B versus B bar. And then you quickly go into the other phase, and these things are just locked in. So you still have the shortcoming of not having enough CP violation, but it's pretty easy to add in new CP violation to the standard model. Like,
yeah. If we have this, are you sort of saying that each, would it be each point of space would get a baryon?
Yeah, but because there's CP violation, you're going to be preferring B over B bar. Okay, so some places will have an excess of B bar over B, some places will have an excess of B over B bar, but because I have CP violation in the Yukawa couplings, which is essentially interaction with this Higgs field, you end up with some total excess of B. So then all of that equilibrates in the new phase, but you're just left with some remnant, essentially. Yeah. So this can work if you had a first order phase transition. I could just add in some new particle with some CP violation, and then it would probably work. But this 125 GeV is very far from 70 GeV. So a lot of work goes into trying to get the first phase transition to be first order. So you still keep B minus L equal to zero, but you have some B and you have some L.
Okay, and the CP.
And the CP picks one, essentially.
It's more likely to go to the right, is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. So that's right. So what you're doing is that you can think of thermal fluctuations as sort of hopping you out and hopping you back. There's some kind of random walk sort of thing, but you always end up back in the middle. But here, if you're sort of, they catch you far out and then it just shuts off, whereas what happens if the Fallerons gradually turn off is that you're just slowing down your hopping. So you're just basically keeping yourself confined to the zero area more likely. Right?
So you're saying with CP violation, you're more likely to move to the right.
That's right, essentially.
But doesn't that just mean if you wait long enough, you're going to get?
No, because then if you have an excess, then you get pushed in the opposite direction because of equilibrium. Right. So that's the whole point, is that you want to break the equilibrium. There's something that wants to move you this way, but equilibrium pushes you back. And so what you're doing is you're cutting off the thing that pushes you back, roughly speaking. So, if you actually want to do this, you have to describe it in terms of quarks sort of bouncing off of this barrier. And the rate of left-handed and right-handed quarks bouncing off the barrier like is different. And so some of them get, so basically this B versus B bar, like this Fallerons act differently on the left and right-handed ones. And so you can create some excess of baryons versus anti-baryons based on the reflection properties. You can start erasing if you want to. But the dynamics is pretty complicated, but just usually when these conditions are satisfied, you do end up with an asymmetry. And so you can kind of estimate the size of the asymmetry by estimating kind of the relative factors from each part. So in the standard model, all of the conditions are satisfied, it's just the factors are too small. So in the second order phase transition typically gives you about 8 orders of magnitude smaller than a first order phase transition. So then if you combine that with the 10 to the minus 20, you get something that's like way, way too small. Okay, so I guess our last class is tomorrow. I think all of you have answered the poll, so I'll announce the dates for the last talks tomorrow in class.